I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. It's Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Decisions around COVID-19 vaccine distribution are frequently described with and informed by language that's often broad and not completely clear. How is a worker determined to be essential? What qualifies as equitable, and how does one define hesitancy or immunocompromised? What criteria should we employ to stop the virus equitably, efficiently, and sustainably? And are we headed toward a world where immunity certification becomes part of our personal and professional lives? The rhetoric and ethics of vaccination. That's on the way today on Midday after the news. Thank you, Andy, and thanks to everybody who has made a contribution in this, our spring membership drive. We very, very much appreciate it. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. 1 year ago today, the World Health Organization classified the coronavirus as a global pandemic. Well, since then, as COVID-19 has ravaged the United States and countries around the world, public officials have used language that's sometimes vague and unclear to explain their decisions, and we are left to use that language to make up our own minds about what we need to do to keep ourselves and our families safe. Today on Midday, it's Midday on Ethics. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. So let's take a look at some of the language that we've employed around COVID-19, and in particular as it regards distribution of vaccines against the virus. To join our conversation with Dr. Kahn, we are at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us today from Palm Desert, California. Jeff, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you.
So some of the language that we have is, in fact, a little obtuse, to say the least. As an ethicist, and you think about how this, in particular, the vaccine distribution has been handled, what data do you wish we had? Do we know enough about what we need to know justly and equitably and efficiently decide who should get the vaccine when, given the fact that at least for the next few weeks, we're in a situation of scarcity?
Yeah, it's been the question that we've been asking ourselves for the last number of weeks now. And I think, I guess I would start by saying there was a lot of really good work done prior to the first vaccines being authorized for use to help establish the priority frameworks, which led the states, including ours, Maryland, to establish priority tiers, 1, A, B, C, and so on. And so that process, I think, went really well. The challenge has been the implementation. How to make sure that the people in those priority tiers are the ones who are getting first and highest, greatest access. And there has been, I think, a real challenge in making sure that was happening and then having data to sort of test what we're doing against the principles, the framework that had been established for prioritization, which, as I said before, really important in the way that those were thought through and making sure that the people at highest risk of severe disease and death were the first to get access to vaccine, and then those who were the frontline healthcare workers and so on. So I think the approach has been good in theory, but not great in practice. It's all about implementation at this point, and it's been spotty at best, and not just in Maryland, but across the whole country and really around the world.
The state of Alaska just announced, I guess, last night that they will now open up eligibility to everybody. So there's no longer any eligibility requirements to get the vaccine in Alaska. And actually, Alaska, since the beginning of this, has been near the top of the list of states successfully distributing vaccines. If you measure it by, you know, per 1,000 people, the number of people who've been vaccinated per 1,000 people. They've always been, you know, performing quite well. What's your take on the way the eligibility categories, you know, are standing up? We are now here in Maryland in phase 1C. So healthcare workers have been taken care of. Folks who work or live in nursing homes putatively have been taken care of. First responders, public safety folks, people in corrections, they were all the very first group. Then we have people who live in assisted living and other congregate settings, and people 75 years old or older. And then we have a category called education and continuity of government. That's 1B. Of course, we have a lot of teachers saying that they don't have access to the vaccine, they can't get vaccinated, and they're, you know, reluctant to return to a classroom as long as that's the case. And now we're in 1C, so adults age 65 or over are eligible, and then what's called essential workers. How do you think these, and as you mentioned, I guess these categories were devised before we even had vaccines to distribute. How do you think they're holding up so far?
Not so well. I mean, so part of it is as you just laid out, different categories, different tiers have been eligible at different times. But as new tiers open, there are still people in the previous tier yet to be vaccinated, either because the supply had been too scarce or because they were hesitant or had trouble accessing, you know, via the internet appointment times. And so what starts to happen is those that were deemed to be at highest priority get crowded out by those who are in lower tiers, but the tiers have opened and they're legitimately now competing. And I use that term intentionally, competing for the few slots available with those who arguably are at higher priority, but we haven't in most, if any places, created ways for those people to get higher, greater priority than the people coming in the later tier. So that's been a real challenge. The other is the assessment of whether individuals are actually in the tier that's currently eligible, and that's been a real challenge. Kind of the vetting and policing of eligibility, and people have found ways to access appointments and vaccines when it wasn't yet their turn, which leads then other people, they anecdotally or firsthand hear those stories, and then others try to do the same. So, you know, unless there's confidence that the tier system is holding up and people will get access in the way that they've been told, people won't sort of wait in line carefully and calmly. I mean, think about what happens, you know, in airports where you're told to not queue up until it's your time, but people start to do it, and then once some do it, all kind of do. There's a sort of herd mentality. And so I think we're experiencing that. Let me say one more thing about your example of Alaska. The smaller states have actually, states with smaller populations, Alaska's a huge state, but small population, have fared better, which I guess is makes sense in retrospect, but I don't think had been something that people had predicted. They're just more able to reach people quickly because there are fewer people to reach. One of the problems with states going to different tiers at different times is that people also find that out, especially people in border states. And there has been, in many states, no requirement that you live in the jurisdiction in which you're getting vaccinated. And so people go to Florida because the age categories have been wider earlier. Harder to get to Alaska, obviously, but people could do the same thing. And so that's also challenging when people don't feel like there's a consistent approach to whose tier is time and are the tiers being adhered to. So sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but I think, you know, we're all experiencing versions of you know, what you described and what I just tried to further detail.
Yeah, no, and I think you did an excellent job of doing just that, because confidence in the system is really key here. I mean, all of us need to think that this has been well thought out, that it is fair, that it is equitable, that it is also the most efficacious, that it's going to vaccinate those people who are at greatest risk first, and then going down, you know, the line. So by the time we get to the third phase, we're talking about the general population, including healthy adults from the ages of 16 to 64. And that's, you know, that's two more phases from where we are now. I mean, obviously, there'll be a whole lot of, you know, post-action reports on this and Monday morning quarterbacking about how this all panned out once this pandemic is behind us. But would it have been, from an ethics standpoint, much better for whatever authority, and we'd have to talk about what authority that might be, to enforce eligibility, to make sure that, first of all, everybody in phase 1A got vaccinated before we started phase 1B or phase 1C, rather than have, you know, as even Letitia Geraza, the health commissioner of Baltimore City, has described as a Hunger Games approach to getting an appointment. Would it have been more ethical, and would it have been ultimately more efficacious in terms of preventing serious disease and death?
Well, and the, you know, the reason for the higher priority, you know, in tier 1A and 1B, then in 1C and so on, was to public health goals, right? That so the answer should be definitely more efficacious from a public health perspective. The challenge is, you know, sort of answering a very basic question, which is, do you wait for everybody in 1A to be vaccinated before you move to 1B? In practice, you cannot do that, partly because people in 1A won't all raise their hand to be vaccinated. There's some, I want to wait to see what happens. There's going to be some hesitancy even after there's experience in the population. So there's going to be some proportion of each tier who either won't be vaccinated or it will take a while to do so. And so we can't wait to open phase 1B only after everybody in 1A gets vaccinated. The problem is, I don't think we've been able so far to figure out sort of the magic formula to making sure that the people who haven't yet been vaccinated in the earlier tiers get somehow greater priority and access. And they aren't sort of outcompeted, as I said before, or as you mentioned, you know, a Hunger Games approach kicks in. And then it becomes very, very difficult for people who are at higher risk and maybe have, you know, less facility with the internet or less access to the internet or less able to travel to clinics, but are at higher risk to get access to something that's, you know, potentially life-saving for them. So this is a lot of the implementation lessons that we'll learn. That's what you said before. There'll be a lot of assessment and, as you say, Monday morning quarterbacking. But, you know, we're trying to learn as we go and do better. To answer your question about vetting and policing, it's really challenging, right? The systems could be set up to make sure that you have to attest to the, you know, you qualify in this tier in this way. And then at the site, I mean, it's difficult, except for things like, do you live in the jurisdiction where this vaccine is being offered? So when we set up clinics in zip codes that are historically underserved and have less access to healthcare, then people who don't live in that zip code shouldn't be getting vaccinated there. That could be easily checked by driver's licenses or utility bill or something. Age is another thing that can be very easily checked, right? Your driver's license has your birth date on it. Once you get past those sort of very easily objectively assessed criteria, it gets really harder to police and vet. And what we don't want, I don't think, are the clinics being in a position of taking time to, you know, figure out whether the person in front of them is eligible. Well, their job is to get as many shots into as many arms as they can in that day. And so we have to figure out where the right place is to do that assessing and that vetting. And I think if we had done better about that in some approach, the people would have learned that if you try to get a jump the queue and get a shot when it isn't your turn, you'll be turned away or there'll be some punishment. And then people won't do it, right? People learn based on what happens to others. The problem is there has been no or very little vetting and policing, and certainly no punishment for those who are able to get a vaccine ahead of their tier. And so that leads others to think, well, if someone did it, someone else did it, I should too, or I can too. And that, I think, is sort of where we are.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We will have more with Dr. Kahn in just a little bit. But first, We are in the penultimate day of our spring membership campaign. If you're not yet a member of WIPR, well, how come? Why not? Here's Andy Bienstock to tell you how you can become part of the public radio family.
Just take a few minutes right now and, well, it's really simple. Just visit WIPR.org, click the donate link, and as easy as that, you can become a member of WIPR. Remember, public radio is here to broaden your knowledge. It's why you listen. But did you know that public radio would not exist without listener support? That's true. Listeners, that means you, are the most important source of our funding. Without your contributions, we wouldn't be here. We think knowledge is something worth paying for. We think there's an inherent value in the knowledge that WIPR brings to you every day. Please take a few minutes, calculate what that knowledge is worth to you, and then make your pledge at WIPR.org.
Thanks, Andy. Again, thanks to everybody who has stepped up during this spring membership campaign and become a member or continued to sustain us as a sustaining member. Maybe you've decided to, you know, up your donation each month. That's a terrific idea as well. We really appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, we're going to finish out the week with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. We always have a good time with Monica, and she always has a lot of great nutrition information to impart. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how the pandemic has changed our eating habits and how we're cooking differently, we're shopping differently, and how food distribution has changed in this pandemic year. So Monica joins us for Smart Nutrition tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. What's your experience been with vaccine and the vaccine rollout? Have you been able to get it? Do you have what some folks are referring to as vaccine guilt because perhaps you're not actually in one of the categories that qualifies right now, but for whatever reason, you were able to get a vaccine, perhaps ahead of the line of some other people who are supposed to get it before you. You can join our conversation and let us know. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWIPR. So Jeff Kahn, would it have been better? Would it have been more, again, efficacious in terms of stunting the disease for there to have been a national strategy that covered all of the states in the same way, because state to state, people are making different decisions. Oregon, for example, prioritized teachers over elderly people for COVID shots. The thought being that they could open schools earlier, and if they opened schools earlier, then they could open businesses earlier. New Jersey has had a controversial plan to put smokers ahead of educators because smokers, having had with a comorbidity, perhaps are at much greater risk for death than a healthy, you know, 35-year-old teacher. What do you think about that? I mean, the fact that things are different from state to state and even county to county or city to city.
It's confusing. And back to our point earlier about people's confidence in the process. I don't know that a single, you know, federal approach would be possible, let alone would be the right thing. But I think stronger federal guidance certainly would have helped, and some kind of coordination so that we wouldn't have what appears to be this sort of scattershot. You know, some states do one thing and some states do another. And, you know, people have families all over the country. That's why I'm in California visiting my elderly parents and in-laws now that they're vaccinated, but they all live in California, but in different parts of California, and their experiences were quite different from each other. So to your point, I think even if there were strong and consistent federal guidance, which we certainly did not have until the new administration came into office, there's still the on-the-ground implementation that the states and the counties and the cities have to be responsible for doing. And I think that's where a lot of the challenges have ended up. So certainly would have been better with different and stronger federal guidance and maybe coordination, but I don't think that would have solved some of the issues that we're seeing. And of course, you know, looking back, we'll be able to say, you know, it would have saved X lives or, you know, slowed down the spread. if we had done certain things. But that would be the case no matter how strong or consistent the guidance would have been. We'll learn a lot. And hopefully, you know, we won't have to use it anytime soon, but it will be very important to be better prepared for the next time.
Rachel Bay, our State House reporter, is reporting that Senator Sarah Elfrith, Sarah Elfrith, from District 30, which is in Annapolis and South County, had risen in the Senate today down in Annapolis to express her anger about the allocations, the larger counties getting smaller numbers of doses than the smaller counties. She quotes a constituent, Shirley, who got an appointment in Wheaton, and her husband had to get one in Easton. She said it was a very long day, but we got our first shots, and Shirley's 82-year-old neighbor and 89-year-old husband were also checking daily, and they didn't have a son-in-law to help them find shots. It just shouldn't be this hard. Where do you think things did break down when you talk about the implementation? How did this get so hard?
I think that we didn't prepare sufficiently, in a nutshell. You know, and it's 2021, right? And to be able to say, you know, the online appointment systems have not worked well anywhere. And I think that's, I'm not saying that with any kind of hyperbole. I think it really has not worked. That's crazy in 2021 that we can't do, you know, internet-based, web-based, app-based appointments. We do it for everything else in our lives. Why can't we do it for vaccines, right? It's not 1918. So that's just a failure. And there will be, I'm sure, a lot of hand-wringing about, you know, why and how. Now, this is where I think federal coordination and guidance could have helped a lot. There could have been, you know, whatever, huge resources poured into the creation of some technologies that would have made this work more smoothly. That, of course, didn't happen. States were left to their own devices, and we have what we have. So I think that's one really important takeaway. The second, which, you know, in retrospect, obvious, but maybe not so much in prospect, the two first vaccines that became available had to be stored at very low temperatures and came in vials that had more than one dose. So when they were thawed, they had to be used within a certain number of hours, creating this very unusual and unexpected situation of extra doses at the end of the day. People don't show up, or they crack a vial, you know, that would serve five doses, or when there's only two or three patients. So what do you do with the remaining two doses? And we, you know, such a precious commodity, we don't want to waste them. And so there's become this sort of vaccine chasing mentality, which you sort of think, why are we in that situation? And so one of the things that's happening is they're going to start creating single dose vials so that at the end of the day, clinics can open just a single dose vial and not be left with extras at the end of the day. So there are all these sort of, you know, sort of in the weeds, nuts and bolts, things about implementation that, you know, would have been hard to see in prospect, but we certainly have learned about both as we go and as I say, better for next time. But I think just a failure to plan sufficiently is the short answer to your question.
410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. Dr. Jeff Kahn is my guest. He is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about the ethics and really some of the rhetoric around the COVID-19 vaccine. So give us a call, send us an email or a tweet to be part of that conversation. And part of the issue that I think a lot of different localities have is the incredible breadth and broadness of some of these categories. When people use the term essential, when we say we're going to, you know, vaccinate essential workers first, who determines who's essential and who's not? Was there any discussion about that? I mean, are there specific guidelines in terms of who is essential?
Well, so each of these, you know, categories has got to have specificity because people start asking, well, do I count? Who's a teacher? Is a question that matters to me, right? Because I'm an educator, but I'm not a K-12 teacher, and I'm not in the classroom. We can do our teaching remotely. So I'm an educator, but but I shouldn't qualify, right, for the kind of teacher that is meant to be vaccinated in an early phase. And we need direction for that kind of example and the example you offered for essential workers. We even had this issue because early on in the state of Maryland, there was a directive to prioritize patients who were immunocompromised. I don't know if people pay attention to that, but that was an issue for us at Johns Hopkins. Without much specificity about who counted, what does that mean? Who falls into that definition? So again, short answer to your question is there absolutely needs to be greater specificity as when we're talking about something that everybody in the population eventually should get, right? So we have to say, you know, when you fall into this category, if you can check these boxes, and if you can't, it's not your time yet. And so there just needs to be much more clarity in the definition of, you know, whose turn is it? And that can and will need to be different in different states. But I think that's a state level directive that needs to happen in every case.
Yeah, and there are different states making different determinations about that. I mean, this term immunocompromised, that's a very broad thing. I mean, people can be immunocompromised for many, many different reasons. Mrs. J sends us a tweet, says, I'm a 47-year-old cancer survivor. Why did underlying conditions like mine end up in phase two in Maryland? I have friends just over the border in Virginia with underlying conditions, and they're getting their shots because Virginia has them in a higher tier. You know, so, I mean, different states are making different determinations, and I'm sure, you know, Governor Hogan is making these determinations in part, or one would hope basically in whole, on the advice of the COVID-19 task force that he put together, you know, a year ago at the beginning of this pandemic. So it's not like, you know, Larry Hogan sitting in the office and deciding on his own, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm not going to do that. So you know, coming up with consensus, I'm sure, is no easy task.
No, that's right. And to the point, you know, states that are near each other are doing different things, which is frustrating. Leads people to go to places where they don't live because they think that they might be able to get vaccinated. And again, it undermines the trust in the process. You know, there's a underlying or overlaying, which either way, this entire conversation we're having is really what's fair, right? What's equitable. And there's a huge parts of the population that haven't been able to get access yet. Not because they don't want it or not because they're not eligible, but because they live in an environment where it's very difficult for them to get an appointment. And then once they get an appointment, find their way to the clinic twice, right, for the two vaccines that were the first available. So we have to do a better job of addressing equity among certain populations, those that have been historically granted less access to healthcare, and it turns out that those are some of the same populations that have historical and understandable mistrust in new medical research and delivery of healthcare. So, kind of a two-pronged problem that I think has also been really challenging to address in Maryland, certainly in Baltimore, but this has been something that everybody's talking about in my world across the country.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and we'll have more with Dr. Kahn in just a little bit. But first, on this day before the last day of our spring membership campaign, we want to remind you how important it is to be a member of WIPR. Listener support is the lifeblood of this endeavor. Here's Andy Beanstock to tell you how to be part of it.
Just visit WIPR.org/donate to make your pledge or call us at 410-235-1395. WIPR is a station that has probably brought you more breaking news over the last year than any other 2 or 3 years combined. special coverage of the 2020 election and the impeachment earlier this year, the insurrection on January 6th, and of course, the pandemic. Since the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus a pandemic 1 year ago today, we brought you dozens of live press conferences and events. Tonight, we'll hear President Biden give a primetime speech to mark the pandemic year. That's at 8 o'clock this evening on WIPR, and we'll continue to go live when we need to in the coming months to keep you informed about our changing world. Members make this special programming possible. That and everything else you hear. You're our most important source of income. Please make your pledge now. WIPR.org/donate.
Welcome back. It's midday. If you've just joined us, it's midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about the ethics of vaccine distribution. We'll try to get to some calls. Let's go to Hannah, who's been patient and waiting on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Kahn.
Hi there. It's good to be on.
And so what's your comment?
So I'm a resident of Baltimore City. I'm 26. I found out that I am eligible for vaccine on Monday, and I managed to get one yesterday. I have autism. It doesn't impact me greatly, but because it is considered a developmental disability, I kind of was shoehorned under. So I'm otherwise healthy. But yeah, I was able to get one really quickly, and I'm kind of struggling with the issues of equity surrounding that.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, we have another email from a listener named Courtney, who says, I'm a student at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and along with many other students, we received an offer for a vaccine appointment because we were affiliated with the school. However, most of the students I know who received the vaccine invitation are not eligible under the current vaccine eligibility criteria. So, Hannah, thank you for that call. And Jeff Kahn, here's Hannah, who was eligible, but still, you know, conflicted, as a lot of people are, given her otherwise very good health.
Yeah. So I think it goes back to the conversation we were having about categories and Hannah's example of individuals with developmental disability being eligible in Maryland now speaks to that broadness, right? So there are people that I'm sure Hannah and you and I would all say, oh, that person with developmental disability definitely is at higher risk based on their situation, their whatever, you know, reason they fall into that category, in ways that maybe Hannah doesn't feel like she does. So we've painted with a very broad brush. The truth is everybody eventually needs to get vaccinated. So it isn't as if you're taking something from somebody who will never get it. It's a sort of when is it the right time to go? And there have been people arguing that, you know, more shots in arms, the better. And we shouldn't be so tied up in, you know, doing this in exactly the right priority, right order. I'm not sure I live in that camp, but I want to sort of be fair that that's part of the argument. It's like, don't feel so bad about having gotten it maybe a little bit earlier than you think you should have.
Little app has gone out for Dr. Kahn. We will get him back on the line. I received an email from a friend who is a retired physician at Johns Hopkins who is volunteering at BCCC, which is the Baltimore City Health Department site for vaccinations here in Baltimore City. And she reports that many appointments are going unfilled, but they won't vaccinate people who just walk in unless they fit the eligibility profile. According to this physician, who's again volunteering at BCCC, 95% of the 400 people that we vaccinated yesterday were African Americans, but she says we could easily have vaccinated 200 more people. One granddaughter came with a grandmother who was wheelchair bound, and she was the primary caregiver, and they wouldn't vaccinate her. So there are places that are enforcing some interesting rules, Jeff.
Yeah, sorry, I had a connection issue there for a second. So that's, again, among the kind of inconsistencies. Some places are saying if you come in as the person who is, you know, accompanying even someone with an appointment and you qualify, you're in the tier that allows you to qualify, then we'll vaccinate you too at the same time, so you don't have to make two trips. Then you have examples like the one that I just heard the tail end of. So again, it's just very confusing for people. And it creates real difficulty for people to have to come back or wait their turn for another appointment, especially when it requires two appointments, right, for the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines.
Yeah. Well, Hannah, thank you for that call. Let's go back to the phones to Sherry, who's calling from Rosedale. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Khan.
I just have a question. Why are we throwing doses away when there are people who desperately need them? Why don't we just give it to everybody and open up the whole thing? Seriously.
So just have no eligibility requirements at all. Just say if you're a human being, you should just get one. Huh?
Yeah.
I mean, and well, it's an interesting idea, and you're not the first to have it, Sherry, and I appreciate the suggestion. So, Dr. Khan, if we did what Alaska's doing, and again, keep in mind, as one of our emailers has reminded us, the entire population of Alaska equals that of the population of the city of Baltimore.
You know, exactly.
Baltimore County has like three times more people in Baltimore County than the entire state of Wyoming. So, yeah. You know, what if we just said, okay, look, if you can get an appointment, good for you, come on down.
Well, I think the problem is we'd have mad rush in the people who were at highest risk. And by that, those who are at greatest risk of becoming really sick or dying if they get infected and, you know, get ill with COVID-19 would be disadvantaged and we'd have more deaths. And so that's just not the framework that has been agreed. So that comes from the CDC, and there's, I think, broad consensus about that. It's the implementation that's frustrating folks. And I do want to say one thing about what Sherry's comment started with. We should not be throwing away vaccines. That should not be happening. And you know, there's all these stories about end of day queues, you know, at every place from giants that have pharmacies to clinics in hospitals to Walgreens and CVS, where you wait, and at the end of the day, the pharmacist announces that there, you know, we have X number of doses, and the first whatever people in line come on in, and they give it to any so they make sure that they are not throwing away doses. So I don't think we're doing that, the royal we in that sentence, and we certainly shouldn't be, because everybody needs to get vaccinated eventually. But it can't be a kind of free-for-all. This is not the system in which we live, nor will it serve the ethics goals that have been set out in advance.
Let's go back to the phones to Irwin, who's calling from Germantown. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Khan.
Well, thank you very much. I get the impression, I live in Montgomery County, that Montgomery County has been disadvantaged relative to all the other counties in Maryland. We have the largest population, and yet there's no vaccination center in Montgomery County. It's located in Prince George's County at Six Flags, but I think it would have been much more effective and efficient if it had been stationed at the University of Maryland Stadium site, which is close to both Montgomery County and Prince George's County. Are there politics involved here that are distorting the distribution rather than equity?
All right, well, thanks for that comment. Dr. Khan, what do you think?
A really good question. There's certainly a lot of discussion about, you know, where to place locations and where to send doses by zip code. And so, you know, there are certain emphasis on parts of our state to make sure equity is served. So the populations that are hardest hit by COVID should get access to vaccine when they're eligible, you know, as a matter of priority. So that's, I think, you know, part of what's driving the locations. I'm sure there are other considerations that I'm just not privy to, logistics and maybe politics too, as Irwin suggests. Hard to know. Maybe we'll learn more about that after the fact. I do think too, as we get to greater supply, the locations that people can access vaccines will expand exponentially, and we'll see, you know, drugstores and many more clinic sites. So it won't be, you know, I have to go to Six Flags to get my vaccine. And we keep hearing that, you know, is about to really ramp up soon, but we've heard that for the last few weeks and it still hasn't quite happened. So, you know, everybody's really hoping that this conversation will be very different come, you know, maybe the beginning of April.
Sure. Valerie in Hamden emails, typical of the frustration that we're hearing from a lot of listeners. She has a friend, there's a college teacher in Virginia who's teaching remotely, and he got an appointment. She is 50 years old. She's healthy. She'd love to get vaccinated, but she says she's probably months away from being able to get on the list. And she says, I'm torn. I'm happy for people who are able to get vaccinated, but I think everybody should be able to get it quicker. Now, in fact, we just have a couple more minutes left here, Jeff, but there does seem to be light at the end of the tunnel in terms of supply. The supply of vaccines is going to increase, we're told, exponentially in just a few weeks. When we get to that point, talk about the ethics of so-called inoculation certification, about whether or not people are going to need, for professional reasons or even personal reasons, travel, whatever, documentation that shows they have, in fact, been vaccinated.
Yeah, this is going to be a really interesting issue, and we probably could devote an entire show to discussing it, actually. But I think we'll see it first in international travel. So it will operate sort of like a passport does now. And so, of course, there cannot go internationally, right? At the moment, borders are closed. And that's terrible for tourism, terrible for airlines, terrible for all sorts of things. And so I think that may be the first place we see it. Then there's going to be all sorts of questions about whether employers can ask employees, whether existing employees or prospective employees, and to show some kind of certification that they have been immunized. And what sort of liberties will those people have who have been immunized versus those who have not? And will vaccination be the only thing that counts, or will have gotten sick with COVID and recovered also count, because you should have some antibodies if you've gotten sick and gotten better, right? Yeah. So all sorts of questions to resolve.
Yeah, and there are, of course, some examples of employers, you know, demanding a particular criteria be met as a condition of employment. And who knows, you know, vaccination may end up being one of those. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and he joins us from time to time for Midday on Ethics. Jeff, thank you so much. Enjoy your visit with your folks and your in-laws, and safe travels when you come back.
Thanks, Tom.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, it's another edition of Smart Nutrition with the one and only nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. We'll talk about what's changed in the last pandemic year, about the way we cook, the way we shop for food, the way we eat, the way we relate to food in general. So I hope you'll join us for Smart Nutrition tomorrow here on Midday. And right now, I hope you'll join us here at WIPR as a member. Members make everything you hear on WIPR possible. If you're not yet a member, think about why that is, and then, well, become a member. Here's Andy Bienstock to tell you how.
Just come to WIPR.org, click the donate link, you'll become a member of WIPR. Remember that public radio keeps you informed about what's happening wherever it's happening, from the federal response to the pandemic, to Maryland's efforts to distribute vaccine, to legislation being considered in Annapolis and at Baltimore City Hall. There's a lot going on these days, and you're able to stay on top of it just by listening to WIPR. Now's the time to get on top of supporting WIPR. Members provide us with the biggest source of revenue we have. We couldn't do it without you, and frankly, we don't want to do it without you. Let's make great radio together. Pledge now, WIPR.org.